Harper's Magazine, March 2025. Under readings, an essay titled Something Amiss by Rachel Cusk from the introduction to a reissue of Martin Amis' novel London Fields, which was published in November by Vintage in Britain. The curse of Englishness is something whose magnitude we are still taking the measure of in our time. The English habit of not finding others as real as themselves forms a substantial part of this curse. It has fallen on numerous English writers. It fell heavily on Martin Amis, A-M-I-S. Many of these writers were perhaps not aware that it was a curse, for it surprisingly often and for long periods wore the guise of a gift. But Amis was aware of it. Amis's father, the novelist Kingsley Amis, was one of the 20th century's great chroniclers of his fellow countrymen. Kingsley Amis was gloriously witty, drunken, bigoted, anti-intellectual, and profoundly lacking in empathy and self-awareness. He was something of an embodiment of the national character. Among the many things Kingsley Amis despised was the notion that a writer might regard himself as an artist. So Martin Amis arrived on the literary scene preternaturally aware of who he was and where he stood. Amis the younger had to shout to be heard. His discovery of the, quote, other, end quote, of that which was not himself and his literary heritage, was therefore especially charged, and the habits of caricature and satire, along with a high degree of authorial self-consciousness that flowed from this discovery, came to define his writing. Martin Amis both suffered from the curse of Englishness and became its archest commentator. In 1989, a little flurry of scandal gave some edge to the Booker Prize proceedings. The two women on the jury threatened to resign if Martin Amis's London Fields, which their male counterparts wished to shortlist, were included. Their reason, at least according to the prize's chair, was Nicola Six, the novel's central female character. The judges found her portrayal unfeminist, in other words, offensive to women. Better, badder, and harder than any man, Nicola Six might also, in fact, pass for a comic book feminist hero. Yet her unbreachable superiority to men is a superiority formulated according to male sexual and intellectual values. It is also her superiority, by the same values, to all women. It was this, presumably, that the judges found to be unfeminist. Still, a truly feminist act might have been to award the Booker Prize to a woman. The overlooked genius Sybil Bedford was on the shortlist. But London Fields was indeed excluded. In its day, the novel did not, in fact, seem to reflect a number of contemporary concerns. Politics, regionalism, the search for equality and social justice, or to address historical realities. With its energy and length and noise, it was, if anything, an American novel. But an American novel that stubbornly concerned itself with something that most English novelists carefully avoid. The, quote, no-fly zone, end quote, of social class in contemporary Britain. This Britain was undergoing a violent phase of evolution. The years of Thatcherism both exposed class divisions and inflamed them. Money and the scramble for it also created a new kind of equality, the equality of opportunism. These were the years in which capitalism shed its pitiless light on the absurd British soul, with its deep striations of caste and station, its post-colonial taint, most of all its perverted emotional core, full of love and loathing for its own extremes of domination and servitude. Who, then, were Martin Amis's readers? The readers to whom, in 1989, this novel addressed itself. I myself, age 22, was certainly not among them. To me, it was clear that Martin Amis wrote for men, or, more accurately, for boys. His humor, I understood, to be puerile, full of the kind of gratuitous line-crossing that young, educated males, insecure in their masculinity, reveled in. That he was the child of Kingsley Amis merely reinforced that impression. He was the perennial son, the enfant terrible, with the emphasis on enfant. His aura of paternal domination may indeed have constituted some of his allure. The boys I knew referred to him affectionately as, quote, Martin, end quote, or even a nickname I feel sure he would have appreciated, quote, Martole, end quote. When I was a little older, I read Money and The Information and found myself becoming more interested. Whether or not I cared much about their content, the openness, the shamelessness of these books was striking. There was also the question of style, of the effort to entertain, a characteristic of the American novel of that period that its English equivalent largely lacked. The spirit of transgression that runs throughout Amis's work seemed continually to hearken to that which lay outside English literature's parameters. The transgression was not, importantly, intellectual. It was more a kind of naughtiness, a daredevil showing off that either thrilled or infuriated its onlookers, who could only wonder what kind of trouble the perpetrator would get into. Whatever else Amis's writing did, it woke people up to themselves, to their secret pruderies or prejudices, to their cultural conservatism. Amis treated imagination not as a refuge from reality, but as a maniacal enlargement of it. And if in doing so he also inadvertently enlarged himself, the brazen tone of his novel suggested that he didn't care. In the Black Cross Pub, the novel's narrator, a failed and terminally ill American writer called Samson Young, mingles with his protagonists, Keith Tallant, Guy Clinch, and Nicola Six. Like Dickens, Martin Amis's character names are a clear signifier of parody. These are, quote, types, end quote, human representatives of current social phenomena, with Keith and Guy, the aspirational thug and the idiotic aristocrat, as the pivotal pairing in Amis's portrayal of a nation and its masculinity in comic decline. Their interdependence and mutual miscomprehension is an illustration of the deep roots of British class perception, a mode of ordering the world whose concealment beneath the junk of modernity belies its extraordinary tenacity. These men, in other words, don't know why they act the way they do. Quote, class never bothered Keith. He never thought about it as such, part of the bygone era, whatever that was. Class never worried him. It would surprise Keith a lot if you told him it was class that poisoned his every waking moment. End quote. Guy, like many a doomed aristocrat before him, mistakes Keith's brutishness for a simpler, more honest masculinity. With his sexually crippling romanticism, he misreads this new alliance for an entry into a greater truth. The women standing behind these men, the ghostly tragic Kath Tallant and the factual Hope Clinch, have far greater contact with reality, yet far less capacity to determine its outcomes. The reason is their duty of motherhood. And one of the usual facets of London Fields is the weight it attributes to babies, to their power of limitation and disturbance, most of all to their power of innocence. Even the wealthy mother, Hope Clinch, cannot control the monstrous possibilities of birth. The intelligent mother, Kath Tallant, is broken in her turn by the self-sacrifice required for the preservation of innocence. In Nicola VI, Amos imagines a woman free of these constraints, her power of sexuality intact, her contempt for men progressively honed by her independence from them, the fact that this woman can retain no interest in living, that as the author of her own story she has no alternative but to arrange her own death, lies at the ambiguous core of London Fields. Amis's rendering of the world of the Black Cross is one of the novel's achievements. Steeped over time in the rancid deposits of male habit, the traditional British pub is rarely so accurately described. In the fog of cigarette smoke, the rituals of maleness are blearily, incoherently performed, their basis in evolution long since lost from view. Broader social changes, multiculturalism, the speed of technology, are diffidently incorporated into the mulch. Slow processes of decomposition and fermentation have replaced the line of history. In the pub, the one discernible truth remains the truth of gender. What men have in common is women. The pub is first and foremost a refuge from women. Occasionally a place to display them, more often a scene of affirmation in the business of subduing them. Amis's intentions with Nicola VI are harder to read, since she is one of the few figures in the book whose caricature isn't meant to produce laughter. He insists that she fully uses and exploits her femininity, yet the degree of pleasure this offers her is unclear. She is clever, cultivated, beautiful, hard-drinking, sexually predatory, and her one weakness, as she sees it, is a penchant for sodomy. The most important thing about her, in the milieu of London Fields, is that she is not a victim. It is she who has victims, who outplays the strategies of men, but to what end? Quote from the novel. Nicola was amused. Again, Nicola was amazed. But how few women really understood about underwear. It was a scandal. If the effortless enslavement of men was the idea, or one of the ideas, then who had a better idea? Why have your chances by something as trivial as a poor shopping decision. In her travels, Nicola had often sat in shared bedrooms and cabins and boudoirs and powder parlors and watched debutantes, predatory divorcees, young hostesses, even reasonably successful good-time girls shimmering out of their cocktail dresses and ball gowns to reveal some bunched nightmare of bloomers, tights, long johns, Y-fronts, to ephemeral flatmates and sexual wallflowers at house parties, and to other under-equipped rivals. Nicola had sometimes carelessly slipped the underwear knowledge. It took about 10 seconds. 6 months later, the ones that got it right would be living in their own muse houses in Pimlico and looking 15 years younger. End of quote from novel. Nicola's ennui, her wanting out from life, is supposedly the consequence of all this strategic knowledge. It is too easy. It makes life no fun. Her interest in Keith lies in her conviction that he, in his stupidity and violence, will be the man to murder her. Amis tries to forestall the criticism that Nicola is merely the stuff of male fantasies by making Samson Young, his narrator, immune to her attractiveness. Samson isn't just terminally ill. He lives in a different register of love and longing. He isn't afflicted by the curse of Englishness, with its inflexible binaries, its violent categorizations of humans, its shaping even of their most secret and shameful desires. If Nicola Six is a fantasy, in other words, she is a culturally determined one. The woman Samson Young pines for is an unyielding executive at a corporate American publishing house, whose soft emotional center he once briefly glimpsed. The politics that made London Fields possible have changed, but not that much. Amis's caricatures retain their links to British reality. His observations about class, gender, and money still find their mark. One significant change from the tabloid-era London is that the novel setting is the evolution of a contemporary media and the explosion of social information it brought about. If anything, the present-day equivalents of Amis's types are more familiar to us than they would have been to the novel's first readers. We see and hear them all the time on our screens. Amis eventually left the United Kingdom, found other subjects, perhaps to try to free himself from the maddening obligation his bristling sensibilities toward the English put him under. One wonders what kind of writer, what kind of poet, even, he would have been had he been born elsewhere. Harper's Magazine, March 2025. A story entitled Why Trees by Hannah Gold. A 10-minute coffee break was called on set, time Laura used to continue her keen propriety staking out of those lives she might still be permitted to lead, and those which were no longer possible. She saw the assistant in her puffer coat handing steaming coffees to the crew, indicating that filming would soon begin. Then her more threatening significance, only somewhat obscured by the bulky outerwear, thin wrist emerged from the sleeves, chin-length hair dyed crimson poured from the hood along with a face that was young and patient, ringing with good cheer. Laura, a few weeks away from turning 30, could not be quite that young again, but she could still wait patiently for the professional milestones that would one day accrue to her, be gracious and charming on her way up, even feign laughter at her co-workers' compulsively genial remarks before they all headed out for the weekend. Although these co-workers, if you could even call them that, were always rotating in and out of the short-lived gigs that she was also rotating through. And so they hardly seemed worth the trouble. She had held down odd jobs for so many years that the cycle had congealed into a routine. On Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, she wrote ad copy, usually at home with little oversight. The work always took less time than she gave her to complete it. For years, she had written copy for movie posters and viral campaigns. Lines like, quote, "This Christmas, payback won't be cheap," end quote. And, quote, "Love happens when you least expect it," end quote. Although for the past few months, she had been reassigned from theatrical releases to the concession stand. Coca-Cola had hired the firm for some contract work, and her boss was throwing just about everyone at it. Between these thrillingly lucrative hours of corporate idling, she doctored treatments for other people's immature attempts at TV pilots or films. Students and other amateurs whose hopes outmatched their talents. This she did less for the pay, which was pitiful, than for the vague notion that industry contacts would materialize, bearing funds and distribution for one of her own screenplays, several of which inched along in the evening hours, and there they remained. It seemed to Laura that her scripts had begun to grow frail in the dark, yet still she counted on the eventual unveiling and on the grandest possible platform, the silver screen. First the festivals, then New York and L.A., then the world would bear witness to her childhood fears, her daily passions and frustrations, her minutely observed existence, all tastefully packaged within, for instance, a buddy comedy or an interplanetary embezzlement plot. Laura showed these developing screenplays to only one person, her boyfriend, Mark. They had met shortly after she moved to the city, when she was a year out of college, and he was beginning a doctorate in psychiatry. Seven years had passed since then, and he still handed back her works in progress gingerly, spotted with black pen on sheets printed out on the campus, where he lectured once a week. It stoked her delicate sense of accomplishment that, although he was 5 years older than her, Mark had been attending school throughout their relationship and was only just now venturing into what she conceived to be as the, quote, real world, end quote, which he had held court, or at least held down jobs, all these years. Quote, "Finally, we're both doctors," end quote, she'd say to him with a one-sided smile, like a fake nudge in the ribs. And yet, certain dynamics between them eluded her. Like that all this time, there'd been this other world, the intimate sphere of their relationship, in which she had been the one getting her papers graded. Mark made every effort to bestow praise on Laura's work, encouraging her to go forth boldly and gather collaborators for her drafts in the public forum, the marketplace of ideas, social media. Quote, "Sometimes it's good to be pushy," end quote, he would say. But neither of them was. Between them flowed acceptance, calm, and the unspoken expectation of a tomorrow. Also, on any given evening, about a mile and a half of foot traffic. They lived in separate studio apartments, two subway stops away from each other, which Mark insisted suited him fine. He had asked to move in with her once, but that was years ago. Laura said it was for his sake as well as hers that they lived apart. Her habit of working late into the night might inconvenience him, leave him sleepless, or worse, whatever injury she inflicted upon him could one day be dumped by the way of transitive property onto his parents, whom she pictured as blank, hapless individuals standing in the streets, staring at the sky with enormous cow eyes, waiting for anvils to drop onto their heads. They were the ones disaster struck. She was the one who made every effort to forestall a bad result. She was careful with money and steadfast in her creative practice. The desk in which she kept her drafts was a wobbly wooden antique, a fully biodegradable item she had acquired for next to nothing. The actors, with fresh cigarettes burning, began to descend from their trailers, drawing closer to the set like a swarm of lightning bugs. The crew was keeping warm in a smoke shop. The scene would take place outside on the snow-covered street, as well as in a bar down the block. It would be a short film in color, quote, but it should feel black and white, like a paperback novel, end quote, insisted the director, who typically shot fashion campaigns in studios and shifted uneasily in the real snow. Laura rolled her eyes from behind the foggy glass panel of the storefront window. The idea the director had proposed to Laura, once they had been put in touch by a photography student of his at Parsons, for whom Laura had done a bit of writing, was to shoot the film from the vantage point of an inhuman and ubiquitous force, something heaven-sent or heaven-bound, which he referred to as, quote, fate, end quote. It was Laura's job to transform the director's abstract vision into a storyline that audiences could digest, not only to write the script, but to communicate its subtleties to the actors and ensure they didn't get too creative with improvisations. But the director hadn't been making any of this easy for her. Quote, a divine force caresses the mortal world, end quote, he had told Laura over Zoom the previous month. The plot concerned two young strangers who venture out on an awkward first date one snowy Brooklyn night. He spoke lightly warped English with a mild Parisian accent. Quote, it's on account of this divine force, this fate, continued the director, that I don't film the faces of the two young people falling in love at all. I used to be obsessed with faces, but now I'm completely over them. Recently, at my day work, I was experimenting with asking the models to close their eyes or cover their faces with a visually arresting object, such as a vase of flowers or a lockbox. Of course, the clients all hate this. They say, Pierre, please focus. They say, the point is not to observe a beautiful young girl holding a pink grapefruit in front of her head. The point is to sell vegan leather harnesses to wealthy 20-year-olds. I am developing early-onset arthritis from clenching my fists all day. So I will make my own films. You see? End quote. The assistant approached Laura, holding a hot coffee between two mittens. Quote, no thanks, said Laura. I'm one of those horrible tea drinkers, end quote. Quote, oh yeah, I heard about you guys on the news, end quote, said the assistant. Quote, real sick individuals, but no, this one's mine, end quote. The assistant wasn't as compliant and bubbly as Laura had assumed moments earlier. In fact, her deadpan tone and lackadaisical manner were a lot like Laura's. Quote, we're a presumptuous lot, us tea drinkers, but helpful. Can I help you with something? End quote. Quote, just wanted to say hi. I'm Sophie. It's my first time working with this director and everyone else here. End quote. Quote, I'm pretty sure it's his first film, end quote, said Laura, nodding at the director, who was smoking a cigarette while munching on a snowball. Quote, and it could be a one-time thing, if you know what I mean, end quote. Quote, right, I gather. Anyway, he wouldn't want me back. I screwed up his coffee order earlier, end quote. Laura inwardly smirked at the characteristic self-doubt of a woman some 8 years her junior. Quote, "Nobody remembers a thing like that," end quote. Quote, "I'll remember it," end quote, Sophie shot back, unfazed by the hint of condescension, if she'd even picked up on it. Quote, "He asked for cold coffee, cold, not iced. He said it should retain the memory of having once been warm," end quote. Quote, "Jesus," end quote. Quote, "Yeah, I panicked and added 2 sugars, but, oh well, I hear he'll be turning 50 soon," end quote. Quote, "Mon Dieu, you wouldn't know it to look at him. He's creased, yet boyish," end quote. Quote, "Here I thought he was just vain. You're Laura, right?" end quote. Quote, "I am. Have we met?" end quote. Quote, "That actor guy Dorian pointed you out," said Sophie, not bothering to scan for him. "He said he doesn't know anyone here, either, except you. I realized talking to him that you and I have a friend in common," end quote. Laura highly doubted this. She had only a few friends and was a microgeneration older than this woman, which surely meant something in the real world. Quote, "Terry McNaught," end quote, said Sophie. Quote, "Excuse me?" end quote. Quote, "Terry McNaught," end quote. Quote, "I'm afraid I don't know such a person," end quote. Quote, "I'm not wrong about this. You're dating psychiatrist Mark, who lives on Halsley Street with a dog with a thyroid issue," end quote. Quote, "Yes," end quote. Quote, "And you're close with Terry McNaught," end quote. Quote, "No," end quote. Quote, "Terry and I worked together on the student debt abolition campaign like a million years ago," end quote. Quote, "That's cool, but I don't know this person, so let's leave it," end quote, Laura suggested with faux kindness. Quote, "You're mistaken," end quote. A conspiratorial comprehension dawned on Sophie's pristine forehead. Laura did not like it one bit. "Okay," said Sophie. Quote, "It's early in the relationship. I get it. I never open up about anything unless I feel like it. My family doesn't even know I drink coffee," end quote. Quote, "And the only thing you know about me is that I drink tea. I've been with Mark for 7 years. It's this Terry McNaught character I know nothing about," end quote. That last comment seemed to send Sophie reeling. She leaned forward and the pace of her words quickened. Laura, absorbed by this sudden change, also bent closer. From a distance, the two women in their big coats could almost be mistaken for a single lurking animal. Then a gasp, and another. In almost no time, Sophie and Laura had managed to untie one knot, only to find a tighter and far more perplexing one at its center. It astounded Laura to learn that Mark was seeing another woman, whose name also happened to be Laura. The affair had been underway for at least 2 months. Laura had never liked the way she looked. It had pained her to discover in middle school that she did not quite look like anyone else, though it was a pain she hardly registered, since it was her conscious wish to be original in everything she did. At 29, a voyage through her Instagram suggestions would sometimes show her on other women her own eyes, nose, or skin tone, less often her figure and hair. Once isolated, these attributes were difficult for her to picture in concert with one another. She was always flicking the incomplete image of herself away, as if too much dirt had settled here, now there. It was the regular self-reproachful state of affairs. But in the days following Sophie's revelations, he had discovered several ways in which she did not recognize herself. At first, feeling nothing, yet watching a wall of pain approach, against which her psyche might splatter, Laura reasoned that it was necessary to discuss the affair with Mark at his and her earliest convenience. She could even indicate over text that their meeting was, quote, "urgent," or, quote, "urgent, ha-ha," end quote. But then she found that she was incapable of sending such a text. She wanted only to run through the streets waving a flag behind her so white and senseless it blocked out the scenery, the sky. She let the weekend go by without contacting him. Then momentarily caught in the ladder-like lines of a crosswalk, she realized she had forgotten what Mark looked like and the sound of his voice. Didn't matter much in any case. He was more of a cause than a person, some way of life that had mattered and sustained her, but was lost, or about to be. How rapidly the rising generation had imposed itself upon her. Yesterday, she had been young. Then she was inside his apartment, standing in his doorway. Quote, "It's 11 o'clock, quote, he said, his robe on, his feet bare. Quote, "All right," she said, "I can see how a thing like that would happen," end quote. Quote, "A thing like what? I've been texting you since Tuesday. I was worried," end quote. Quote, "And that makes it what day now?" end quote. Quote, "It's Wednesday," quote, said Mark. He was a man of average height, with a little round belly and a delicate snub nose. The bone structure in his face was all hidden, and he smiled easily, which made him look trustworthy. His curly brown hair was thinning on top, in the shape of a muddy footprint, none of which Laura could see clearly because the apartment was dimly lit. Mark had been asleep. Quote, "The day after Tuesday," end quote. Quote, "It's almost Thursday," end quote. Quote, "But I didn't come here to enumerate the days of the week, Mark. No, I have serious questions to ask you. Like, where's the effin', 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 effin'?" end quote. Mark stared at her with his mouth open, as if he had been interrupted. But he hadn't been interrupted. Perhaps, thought Laura, he meant to show her that she'd interrupted years of his life, and that all this time he'd been standing around trying to successfully yawn just once. Quote, "Laura, what's wrong?" end quote. Quote, "I know you know I know, and I feel like a petitioner standing in your doorway like this," end quote. Quote, "All right, yeah, come in, take a seat," end quote. They settled onto a lumpy gray sofa in the living room portion of his studio apartment. He began by telling her a story. At the hospital in the real world where Mark worked 4 days a week, the nurses had gone on strike. Hospital administrators had warned the staff against becoming discouraged or speaking with reporters at this challenging moment. They urged professional neutrality. Mark didn't like to be reminded that sickness and death turned a profit. It made him feel ashamed. So when the reporter reached out, he responded. He was off the record, and the reporter wasn't intrigued by what he had to say, since he had heard it all before. But she listened. Her name was Terry McNaught, she told him, also off the record, that if he wanted to, quote, plug, end quote, into, quote, the movement, end quote, perhaps in a way that wouldn't put his new job in jeopardy, he could stop by a potluck her friend was organizing later that week. Terry wouldn't be there, but she could place him on the email thread. 15 days later, he rose early to cook a vegetarian chili that traveled with him to the hospital in a little plastic pail that had once contained pickles. Later, it sat cold and condensing in his lap on the train to Bay Ridge. When he pushed open the door, he felt transported back a decade to a time when he and everyone he knew was minimally paid and proudly careless with their possessions. The dirty floor was barely visible beneath the immense clutter of half-broken furniture. Utensils and cooking appliances were streaked with saucy refuse, and people were packed together, yelling as if there weren't just 2 centimeters of void between them. The air was scented with garlic and nutritional yeast, and Laura was there. Quote, "Too confusing," end quote, interrupted Laura. Quote, "Refer to her as the other Laura," end quote. Mark nodded, his expression difficult to make out. The other Laura was organizing the tenants in her building, which was owned by a management company that shared its listed address with a local Burger King. She also worked as an assistant at a museum during the week and wrote poetry, which she read at bars that used Christmas lights liberally. She was excited to meet a psychiatrist. One of her friends, not at the party, was having a difficult time dealing with a host of phobias that included diseases, disease vectors, and potluck-type situations. Initially, this was all they discussed. When he followed up with an email to the other Laura, promising to suggest treatment options for her friend, he honestly hadn't thought much of it. Quote, "This isn't working," end quote, interrupted Laura again. Quote, "Still too confusing and painful. Refer to her, please, as the replicant," end quote. Quote, "The replicant? Laura, I don't really think," quote, "tonight you must do exactly as I say," end quote. Laura had begun sweating lightly in the poorly insulated room. It was only after he had slept with her, the replicant, for the first time, they began to appreciate the novelty of a thing. Not the physical cheating, although that was new too, but caring for another person, and that way being curious enough to see what would come next. That had never happened, not in 7 years. It was clear he hadn't gone out of his mind or his body, since it was his mind that kept thinking about her and his body that wanted hers. She wanted him too, and unconditionally. She didn't mind sharing. In the 2 months he had known her, she had never suggested that what they were doing was wrong or that there was a prescribed set of steps he needed to take. Meanwhile, nothing about his relationship with Laura had changed. They continued to enjoy each other's company, and he wasn't so lonely now when they were apart, which was nearly all the time. In especially happy moments, he had even believed Laura wouldn't be bothered when she eventually inevitably found out. Maybe they were just naturally drifting toward an open relationship. She was an artist, after all. They had their own apartments, their own lives, and each other. Now they could invite others in and be honest about it going forward, as he had not been, for which he was sorry. So very sorry. Quote, "Like, maybe this is a step forward for us," Mark said. "Ironically, the two of you, that is, the replicant and yourself, would probably get along," end quote. Quote, "It's not irony, Mark. It's just a falsehood. Would you care to know how I feel about all of this?" end quote. Mark nodded vigorously. Laura inhaled. The words came to her just as she needed them. Quote, "What I feel is that the replicant has ruined my life. She invaded my home, took photographs of it, ransacked it, then built an entirely new home that looks exactly like my old one before it was destroyed. Pretty soon she'll be charging admission and inviting our old friends by, plus all these new people, and getting rave write-ups in the local papers, which are read all over the world, with headlines so fawning they summarize the article for you. And now I have to live in this disgusting, destroyed, fallen world. I'm the human element in the pile of detritus nobody wants anymore. And none of it was up to me," end quote. Mark said nothing. He was always too accepting of her feelings. Why couldn't he just once stand in her way, beg her not to leave, or at least tell her she was wrong? Quote, "I bet you met her at a bar," end quote, said Laura finally. Quote, "No. What? Should I give you her email? She can confirm what I've said. Why would I lie?" end quote. Quote, "I can think of so many reasons why you would lie. To seem like a good guy, for instance," end quote. Quote, "Actually, I did just start doing some more mutual aid work, delivering medicine to neighbors and whatnot. Just, I mean, trying to be an open book about it and all," quote. quote, "Shut up, Mark," end quote. Laura wiped her palms on her jeans. Quote, "Okay, Laura, sure, you got it. I'm so sorry, I," end quote. Then Mark got up, and she heard a whoosh like the sound of the tiniest window opening. Only it was her boyfriend fumbling with the light switch, and suddenly the room was the brightest thing she had ever seen. She had to shade her eyes with her hands and shut them tightly. As she reluctantly peeled open her eyes and saw Mark's face covered in a fine film of tears, and she felt this couldn't be him, that he too had been replaced. She had never seen his face this miserable before. Sympathy, though, was out of the question. She despised the replicant, and that was all. And him, by association, for bringing the replicant into her life. Quote, "Original taste. It means it's the same everywhere. No matter where you go, you get the delicious beverage you love. And that means what? That the advertising needs to be targeted. It means that everywhere you go, you get the same ads you love, or whose quirky humor you approve of, or whose impossible images of success you yearn to live up to. But let's just say love. It's shorter. We all have different ideas of what love is, right? Different patterns of seeking, of wanting. We know it when we taste it," end quote. The following afternoon, Laura's boss, Mr. Crankle, was conducting a Zoom training for 7 new permalancers. Laura and a couple of other old-timers were, quote, "supervising," unquote, by which was meant, quote, blinking and smiling, end quote, and if they had slept more than 5 hours, perhaps giving an occasional nod to the camera. Laura had not. Quote, "Your job," end quote, continued Mr. Crankle, quote, "is to ferret out those differences, build those psychological profiles, locate their social networks. Brains in a jar chattering nonstop, narrowing their tastes and accumulating more of them all the time. We know this. They know this. We're not fighting. We're not tricking. Never trick. It says, quote, original taste on the can, and that's all we're giving them, just in their own words. Now, I don't envy your task. I'm a manager. I want to solve every problem by delegating. But you're imaginative. You're writers. It'll be easy for you, all right? Let's open up this Hollywood Squares convention for questions. Anyone else remember that show, Hollywood Squares? Just me?" End quote. Brian T. put a thumbs-up emoji in the chat. Well, all right, Brian. Okay, all right. Brian T. knows what I'm talking about, end quote. Laura had heard Mr. Crankle spiel dozens of times before, but didn't remember despising it this viscerally. She wondered how the Laura she had been, the Laura of a few days ago, would have spent thousands of hours tinkering in her workshop of consumer egos, like she was God of selling soda, had stomached it. It must have given her a sense of well-being, she thought, to presume she could figure people out, entire groups of people, over the course of a project that never took longer than a few weeks to complete. She used to picture subway cars like those she occasionally took to meetings with Mr. Crankle at a cafe in Midtown that he liked because they always played Sting. The walls of the cars were covered with ads aimed at captivating a particular kind of person, and everyone on the train had the seed of that particular person somewhere inside themselves. It needed only a little water and soil to take root. They were a fascinating swirl of passions and organic materials, these strangers who rode the train through her mind. Twistable souls, sentient fizz. This wasn't creative work, and Laura never confused it with the pages she kept in her drawer. It was a living. Artists have to make do somehow. But really, thought Laura as she stared at her laptop into 20 hungry eyes, the advertisements had supplanted the words in the drawer. They'd become the only words, all anyone ever saw. And she didn't regret them. In fact, she had come to accept them. And more. She felt powerful in her indifference toward them, which was like a splinter of the divine indifference that offered people everywhere no choice but to submit to their fates. Quote, Brian T., am I running this seminar or are you? Just kidding. Don't worry. I'll only be taking up another 45 minutes of your time, Max. Let's turn to page 16 of the employee manual, end quote. Laura had skimmed the manual so many times it felt like something she herself had written, believing every word. She minimized the window in disgust and clicked over to her unsent mail. It was intended for the replicant. Or maybe for nobody. She hadn't decided yet. The thought of sending it had kept her up all night. In the morning, she had cut 1,500 peevish words down to an elegant, contemptuous 5. Let's talk. Quote, let's talk, Laura to Laura, end quote. On the one hand, she didn't want to learn a single additional fact about the replicant. And on the other, there was no denying her sudden, all-consuming presence in Laura's mind. Not to mention the unraveling of their 7-year relationship, although she found it easy not to think of Mark. She was already in the habit. She imagined the conversation she'd had with Sophie playing out for all eternity, the life she thought she was leading becoming continually, casually mistaken for another's. Mark bragging about, quote, Laura's, quote, accomplishments, saying, things are really going well with Laura, and I've never been happier. And his most tactless friend, Justin, the vole-like fellow with the baseball cap addiction, would ask, whatever happened to that other Laura? Just another Laura. Was this her destiny? The fantasies felt nauseatingly real. They were violating, unacceptable, and all the more so because it did not explain the terror that occasioned them. Her face on her computer screen, caught in the gaze of her webcam, was mercifully small, its eyes frozen in desperate concentration. Scanning the pages of the employee manual for dear life, one might assume, she was hitting send. It was done. But the acceptable feeling only intensified. She recalled the existence of Pepsi, how bad it tasted when compared with the real thing. A few days later, Laura awoke to the sound of her cell phone ringing. She could see on her phone screen that it was 6 a.m. Still dark out. She'd been asleep for only a couple of hours and yet felt entirely ready to get up, continue on with the next thing. These days, she wasn't living her life so much as keeping vigil over it. She hardly rested. Ambient dread had raised her defenses against loneliness, sleep, memory, longing. Only fixations penetrated. Whatever kept her alert and moving. It was the director calling. Quote, hello, Laura, end quote. He sounded positively thrilled, as out of step with the hour as she was. Quote, good morning, end quote. Quote, I was going to leave you a message. What an unexpected pleasure it is to hear your voice. We're surfing on the same wave, you know. I was just going over the final edit of your little film, end quote. Quote, ah, the little film, tell me, end quote. Quote, it's beautiful, Laura, just 10 minutes long, but your dialogue is so radical, so real. When we panned to the pattern of the tablecloth and the wine glasses moving swiftly over it as the narrator gives 5 dictionary definitions of ego death, that destroyed my mind, end quote. Quote, Pierre, merci beaucoup, I'm touched, end quote. She was sitting on an email from the replicant, who had responded within an hour of Laura's reaching out. This haste seemed somehow shameless. Quote, "A new idea came to me in the middle of the night. It is my greatest passion, and I am quite eager to share it with you, Laura. Can you come over sometime?" End quote. Quote, "How about now?" End quote, said Laura. She felt that were she to linger in bed a moment longer, she might wind up staying there all day, glued to a hypnotic sense of disbelief in her own life. The director lived in a narrow L-shaped apartment in the village, with floor-to-ceiling mirrors on three walls. No windows in the living room, very clean, with black leather furniture and hibiscus plants that would luge and aquatic beneath soft sprays of track lighting. On the walls, a mix of exposed brick and stucco, hung what appeared to be a large blurry photographs of coiled galaxies, although they might have been platters of recreational drugs served up on vinyl. There was no way to know. The atmosphere was charming, crass, and rather technical. Pierre greeted Laura wearing black pants and a loosely draped button-down print of Le Monde headlines. Quote, "Please keep your shoes on," end quote, he said. Quote, "Unless it is your preference to take them off. For my part, it is my preference to sweep," end quote. She gave him her coat to hang in a closet. He returned carrying what looked to be a pair of black mourning veils. Quote, "If you'd like," end quote, he said. Quote, "We could wear these veils. It is actually something very cheap you can buy at any mall. You put them on like headbands. They are part of my experiments with face blindness," end quote. Laura thought, could I sue him for this? They sat in a breakfast nook, she on the leather love seat, he on a leather folding chair. Laura found herself wondering what sort of sporting event one could bring a chair to. What kind of sporting event one could bring such a chair to? Open-air competitive body piercing, perhaps? She gazed into the mirror behind the director and could hardly make out the slopes and planes of her countenance beneath the black web of cheap netting. For the first time in years, she did not immediately avert her gaze. The reflection satisfied her. On the other side of the window, the sky turning a violet red. Quote, "Please excuse my sloppy shirt and bag eyes. I have already been up for hours arguing with my colleagues, friends, and cousins. The Parisian is awake while we remain sleeping, and I like to get right to it," end quote. Quote, "What do you argue about?" end quote, asked Laura, hoping not to find out. Quote, "It's not what that matters, but why. I think we are too similar, too familiar. Same field, same age, same family. I'm like everyone else in my generation. We work hard, nurture our delusions. We are aesthetes. We want to be excellent, but we can't come together. And I am the same. I don't want to join in with them. Just like them, I'd rather compare myself to something outside, to the millennials, for instance, who entrance and repulse me. Not you, Laura. I'm speaking broadly. I think that what I am trying to say is something like this. I'm obsessed with alienating myself from people," end quote.